Is this mic on?
Boy.
It's on. There it is. Okay. I don't know why I keep doing this. It happens every time. Technology sometimes is not a good thing. I could talk loud if it does go out, though. I wanted to mention a few things to you. First of all, I wanted to mention, and this is just a dad talking, last night, Abby's volleyball team, Cumberland Valley, for the first time in the school's history, they won districts. And so congratulate Abby. She's the one with the streak of CV red that she couldn't get out of her hair and ruined her pillowcase last night. And Peg McClurg, a lot of you know her. She was baptized this summer. She'll be taking off life support today. She had a massive stroke last night. I was up at the hospital to see her, and obviously she's not doing well. And it'll be just a matter of when the daughter comes, they'll begin the shutting down process. So be praying for that family. We'll let you know when and where the funeral will be. And Golden Living is joining us this morning. We have about 10 or 15 people over there today, and I'm sure there's probably 15, 20 of the residents there, and so that's going well. And then I want to especially make mention of the Fazells. They're watching tonight. I went over and set their computer up. They're at Country Meadows, and so every Sunday morning now they can join us in worship. And welcome, James O. and Beverly. I said I would do that for you, and I did. And there's a lot going on this week with the election, and I wanted to have a little bit different lesson. It's two parts, this morning and tonight. I don't want you to think of it in terms of politics, though. I want you to think of it in this term here, that one person can make all the difference. And that's what I aim to prove to you this morning and this evening. At noon on May 15th in 2008, a funeral was held for 98-year-old Catholic widow named Irina Sendler. And most people her age have a small funeral because they outlive nearly everybody in their circle. But not her. The church was packed, and even though she was Roman Catholic, it was filled with Jewish people. The reason why so many from all over the world came to her funeral is because she was a person who made an impact on many thousands of lives. She was somebody who made a difference. To better understand, it's important to go back and focus on what the participants of the funeral were saying. See, Irina was born on February 15th, 1910, to Mr. and Mrs. Stan, I hope I say the name right, Krasiska, whatever. Can't say that. That's what happens when you cut back on caffeine. But she was born on the east side, east side of Warsaw, Poland. And by the age of seven, her father died of typhus, and it left her to be raised by her single mother. And though she was Catholic, by age 10, her passion against the anti-Semitism in that country, it was growing very much, and she just really was very vocal against that. She reflected later on in life, "I was brought up to believe that a person must be rescued when drowning, regardless of religion or nationality." And this led her to be educated and employed as a social worker in the ghettos of the Polish Welfare Department. And she headed this agency when the Germans invaded in September 1939. And as the persecution and murder of Jews in Poland spread by the hands of the Nazis, she made a decision she was going to make a difference in their lives. And so what she did was she secretly formed an underground group called Zagoda, which it was in reality the Council to Aid Jews is what it was for. And she headed the group up, and her cover name was Jolanta. And the Nazis sent her into the Jewish ghetto to head up the effort to contain a typhus epidemic that infested it. And what they did not know was that Irina and 24 of her comrades had prepared to smuggle out Jewish babies that were destined for the gas chamber. And so the penalty for assisting Jews was death. If the Nazis caught you, you were going to die. But she did it anyway. And some of the babies were strapped underneath the gurneys as they would go in. They'd strap one up underneath the gurney. Some of them were in suitcases. Some, when they went to package up, they put them in boxes and tucked them inside the truck. She even brought one baby out secretly in a toolbox. And if the baby was small enough, she can get it. And the toughest part of her job, she said, was asking Jewish parents in the ghetto to give up their children. "Can you guarantee they will live?" she was asked more than once from an agonizing parent. "No, but if they stay here, I guarantee you that they will die," was her stock reply. "You shouldn't trust me, but what else can you do?" Well, Irina saved more than 2,500 babies and placed them with other Polish sympathizers. She kept two detailed records in two jars, very detailed records on who the birth parents were. She buried them near a fruit tree in the yard. And after the war, she had planned to try to unite them with the parents that they were still alive. But most of them did die. I believe all but like 500 of those groups of parents were gone. And there was actually a movie written back around 1999 called Life in a Jar. I'd recommend you maybe watch that. And when the Nazis discovered her, she was arrested in 1943 after doing this for a few years. They caught her and they began to beat her severely. They broke both her feet, broke both her legs, and they just continued just to maul her. She passed out under that horrible persecution. And when she woke up, she was expected to be executed. She was drug out, unconscious, and the last thing she heard was "executor." Well, before the executioner could take her out into the woods to shoot her, some of the members of her group paid him a large sum of money, and then she was allowed to escape. And they took her. She hid for the remaining of the war. And the thing that upset her the most was that she couldn't save more of the children. During the funeral ceremony, Teresa Kerner, one of the girls that she had saved, she was now a doctor. She recalled how Irina had helped her move several times to safe houses, then actually had her live in her home for 2 years after the end of the war. And many others that she helped also had great things to say. And they had spouses, and they had children, and some even had grandchildren by them. Tens of thousands of lives were affected by this woman's decision. In 1965, Israel awarded her the Righteous Among Nations Award. She was in a wheelchair toward the end of her life, courtesy of the wounds she received at the hands of the Nazis. And her only regret was, "I wish I could have saved more." She saved far more than Schindler did, and yet you may not have even heard of her. The life of Irene Schindler is quite impressive. And it's simply because of her willingness to come to the aid of the most innocent of our society at such a time of worldly ugliness. She was one person that made a difference for thousands of individuals. And with that in mind, the title of this two-part series is "One Person Can Make All the Difference." That's a fact. History is filled with individuals that have made all the difference, either to the good or to the bad. And then there's this large group of people in the middle, and they are not making, nor are they seeking to be an effective influence in the lives of those around them. That's the focus. And there are three sections I want to answer in these two lessons. First, understanding the reality that we as Christians are called to be people that can make a difference. And number two, understanding what those qualities are in those individuals who have made a difference. And the third thing then is to take possession of those facts and to incorporate them in our lives so that we can be who Christ wants us to be. And so, first I want to talk about how we as Christians are called to be people to make a difference in this world. Jesus said in Matthew 5, verse 13, that you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its savor, how will it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything but to be thrown out and trodden under by foot of man. You see, life in the ancient world did not have the luxury of refrigerators and freezers. And, a lot of items like fruit, wine, and grains, they'd be okay for a long time. But when it came to meat, they had to do something with it. You don't want to eat like a spoiled piece of meat. You could have death come upon you. And so because they didn't have refrigeration, what they would do is they'd have a salty paste that they would put together. And they'd make all meat like beef jerky. It'd be just dried out with salt. It would keep germs from coming upon it. And so what would happen is, they'd have this big salty chunk of meat. And it was a valued commodity. How could salt be a valued commodity? Well, pure salt, quality salt. Because Roman soldiers were actually paid bonuses many times in salt, which is where the saying comes from, this man is not worth his salt. It came from the Roman soldier who did not do a good job for his higher up. When he got paid, he may have got his funds, but they didn't give him his salt. But how does salt lose its saltiness? Salt is salt, right? Yeah, salt is salt. But many times, this salty paste would be kept in earthen jars. And whatever elements was in the clay, it would begin to bond with the salt that was in there. And so it might become, instead of sodium chloride, magnesium chloride or potassium chloride, whatever was prevalent, then it would take that on. If you've ever tasted fake salt, it's kind of nasty. You remember that stuff they had in the 80s? Made you not want to eat popcorn again. This is better for you. Well, maybe it's better to fast at the movie theater. And so what would happen is when that paste would turn on them, when it would turn ugly, if they didn't get out and put on the meat and let it do what it needs to do, they would then turn it into weed killer. They'd spread it around the outside of their homes and on paths and up on the roofs, which were patios in those days, to kill the weeds. And hence, it would be trodden under underfoot by man. And the summary is that Jesus wants you and me to be salt of the earth. He wants us to get out of the shaker and onto the meat so that our preserving qualities that are in us through Christ is affecting the world in a way that more people don't have to go to hell. More people don't have to rot in an area they don't want to rot in. You see, Jesus Christ, he said, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. And the world isn't going to go out there and do Jesus' work. It's his people who does Jesus' work. The Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. That's what he has on the job app. That's why he's here. He's not willing that any should perish, but all come to the knowledge of the truth. And Jesus is saying, get out of the shaker, get on the meat. Because if you're not on the meat, you're just going to be trodden underfoot by man. And that was a great insult in Judaism, to come in contact with feet. And I want to look at a couple individuals this morning. And then tonight I'm going to cover five more. And I want you to see through people who have done it from the Bible, qualities that stand out. That if we seek to have these qualities in our life, we're going to be that salt. We're going to be that light of the world that Jesus calls us to be. And first on deck is Joseph. Joseph. He was a person who, a person who dreams big can make a difference. He has a first dream in Genesis 37, 5 and 6. He had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. And he said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, they were binding sheaves in the field. And lo, my sheaf rose up and stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brothers said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more. You know, the older you were in the family, the higher you were up on the pecking order. If you were the oldest brother, you got the most respect. Joseph was way down there. He was a late one. His name meant add another, and that's where Benjamin came along. And so for him to have this big dream that God imparted to him was quite offensive to his brothers. But to make matters worse in their eyes, he had a second dream. And in this dream, where the sun, moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to him, even they were saying, "What shall Jacob said, shall I and your mother bow down to you? Shall your brothers bow down to you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. And here he is again. And they will bow down. Between chapter 42:6 and 44:14, you see him bowing down four times to Joseph, because he later became the prime minister of Egypt, second only in power to Pharaoh himself. And he held that dream that he had for nearly three decades, but it was a dream. Now, some of the greatest influences in history have had a dream. You have a civil rights leader that had a dream that you've all heard about. You have some that in ingenuity and business had a dream, some in politics, some in education. To be the one person whom can make the difference in the world, just like Thomas Edison, just like Martin Luther King, just like everybody else, you have to have a dream. You have to see it in front of you, or it's not going to happen. Nightmares can happen. If you have a nightmare, that could happen in a bad way. But you have to dream big to reach big. And the application is, how do we gain such a dream? Does God impart to us a dream like Joseph? Yes and no. Yes, he imparts a dream, and no, not like Joseph. Because our dream as Christians is a dream that we had come true when we came up out of the waters of baptism. See, our dream which God imparts to us is not about having the family of Jacob bowing down before us, but bowing down to God in heaven, eternally glorifying Him, praising the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. We're going to honor Christ for eternity, and that's a dream that we have. Revelation 4, verse 10 and 11, all of heaven will, quote, fall down before Him who sits on the throne and will worship Him who lives forever and ever, saying, "Worthy are You, our Lord, our God, to receive glory and honor and power, for You created all things, and because of Your will they existed and were created." We can say we have a dream as Christians. Our dream which God has imparted to us is not about going to Egypt for grain, but dining with God at His table in the heavenly realm. Revelation 19, verse 9. He said to me, "Write, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb." We're not going to Egypt. We're going to heaven. We're not going to be eating grain. We're going to be dining in the finest ways with the finest guests. Our dream, which God imparted to us, does not generate hate from brothers, but it unites from love of the brothers. There'll be no tears, no sadness, nor pain, and all things will be made new. And they will not have need for the light of the lamp, nor the light of the sun, for the Lord God shall illumine them, and we're going to reign with Him forever. We have a dream. And if you ever, ever plan on being effective, if you want to be that one person that makes a difference, you had better have a dream. And our dream is already picked for us. We're going to heaven. I mean, Do you realize how that dwarfs everything we have down here? I mean, like, I've had a bad issue with my back this week. And, I mean, a couple of times, you know, it's like when you're walking and it locks. All of you over 60 know what I'm talking about. You hope you have somebody to grab at that time. I mean, it's been hurting bad. But now put that pain, it seems real big, put that pain on the backdrop of a mighty God who says, you're going to be with me forever and no one will touch you again. That makes it pretty small, doesn't it? Maybe it's just the adrenaline you have when you get up and preach, but my back's feeling good right now. Let's go to the gym, okay? And so, number two, and this is the best example we could have. It won't take long. I'm almost done. Come back tonight. We cover five more. There are seven elements you have to have if you're going to be effective. If you're going to be that one person who can make all the difference. Well, let's use Jesus. What better way to close the sermon than on Jesus? Jesus Christ, a person who is sacrificial, can make all the difference in the world. There are many words that we can use to describe Jesus, like love, passion, and power. But the one to me that stands out the very most is sacrificial. Jesus sacrificed his time. Everywhere he went, crowds would throng him simply to have a moment of his time. When crowds were hungry, he took the time to feed them. When people were hurting, he took the time to heal them. When people were depressed, he took the time to encourage them. And when they were ignorant, he took the time to educate them. Jesus was all about sacrificing time. If you add up all the things he did, all the books in the world couldn't contain what he did in his time down here on the earth. That's why we just got to keep reading the Bible over and over again. He sacrificed comfort. You know these earthly comforts that he had? He summarized it up in Luke 9:58. Foxes have holes and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. You see, Jesus, he had a life on the road. I mean, he was always moving around. He often was hungry, Matthew 4:2. He was thirsty, John 19:28. He was lonely, Luke 22:42. All those things that come that you have as comforts, he didn't have those. He didn't have all the creature comforts that we have today. Jesus didn't have a large bank account. Jesus didn't have all the luxuries. He sacrificed his possessions. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I was ringing. I thought, how could it be? I don't have that ring. What is that verse? Let your cell phones be silent in church. Where is that? No. We love you. But he sacrificed his possessions. He was born a king in a manger and not a palace like all those other kings. He was not concerned about earthly wealth, but heavenly treasure, Matthew 6:19. He even had his possessions, his meager possessions, divided up with the roll of the dice at the bottom of his cross, Mark 15:24. He was sacrificial in every way concerning his possessions on this earth. But most of all, he was sacrificial in his life. This is the basis of God's love for us. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. And there's no greater love on earth than this. As Jesus would say in John 15 verse 13, greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Jesus dove on the grenade for us. He took the bullet for us. That was our spot on the cross. And Jesus knows that we cannot survive it. And Jesus died on that cross for us. He jumped in front of the assassin's bullet. And all he wants is a thank you and a committed relationship with him. And he'll dive in front of that bullet all day long for you. But will you give him a chance? And when we understand this love, that sacrificial love that Jesus had for us, then we can finally be somebody who will make a difference in other people's lives. 1 John 3:16. We know this. We know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, that we all ought also to lay down our life for the brethren. If you want a sacrificial life for every person you ever run into, you focus on what Jesus Christ did for you, and you're going to find out you're going to make a difference in people's lives. And so the application is, Jesus was the one who made a difference in more lives than anyone who ever walked the earth. You know, Irina may have saved 2,500 babies, but Jesus has saved souls without number. And He has room for more. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, but I go now and prepare a place for you. Why? So you can come and be with me. Jesus has a mansion for us to go to. He's built a condo for you, and the association fees are waived. What are you waiting for? No interest. No, it's 100% interest in you. And so the question is, He's been gone for 2,000 years, but does He reside in your heart as a follower of Him today? Because that's what's going to matter. When we tap into this sacrificial life of Jesus, then we'll be sacrificing our time, our comfort, our possessions, and even our lives if we have to. If you want to be someone who can make a difference in the lives of many, then we have to focus our minds on the sacrificial Savior, Jesus Christ. When we come back tonight, try to come back tonight, five more qualities that we have to have. But if we do those things, we'll make a difference in the lives of so many people. You know, it should always be our goal to take as many hostages, willing hostages to heaven that we can. If you got to smuggle them out under a gurney or stick them in a toolbox, you do whatever you have to do. But just explain to them that Jesus does love you and do your best to bring them into the kingdom. If you have not yet become a Christian and you would like to be, we offer you this moment to come forward. Don't put it off any longer. Or maybe you don't know. Maybe you're not sure. You want to study more? Come forward for that. Maybe your heart is broken. Come forward for that. Maybe you want to be part of this church family. Come forward for that. Let your intentions be known while we stand and sing.